Hello and welcome to the Celeste Stein Show. I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein, and we invite you to like, share, and subscribe to my channels on bbsradio.com and YouTube. We cover a variety of topics here on news you can use, self-help topics, and entertainment. This really helps us in getting important information out to people, and so we really appreciate your support. On today's show, we are planning to speak with someone who has a wealth of experience for more than 15 years in the area of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Dr. Jason Gines is the lead administrator for the Office of Diversity, Belonging, Inclusion, and Equity at the Pembroke Hill School in Kansas City, Missouri, in the U.S. He has successfully orchestrated trainings for faculty, personnel, administrators and board of trustee members. And I understand he initiated a new system-wide program that resulted in a 100% rise in DBIE equity participation. Dr. Gines, very impressive. Welcome to the show.
Dr. Celeste and Dr. Stein, thank you. It's so good to be here with you this morning.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very, very much. Because, we've already had a little chat and I know you have such a unique perspective on diversity, belonging, inclusion, and equity. And I've really enjoyed our conversation previously and thought it would be great to have you on to talk a little bit more about the topic. Now, I really wanted to begin our conversation by having you to define diversity, belonging, inclusion, and equity.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think while there are many definitions that float depending on the domain you're from, generally agreed upon definitions for diversity are it is the presence of both phenotypical, both hidden and invisible difference, right? So this is anything from race to gender to height, to weight, to anything that makes one different in a particular space. Diversity represents that. It is expansive. It is an expansive term. Though many people, when they hear diversity, it becomes a dog whistle for just race, but it is much broader than that.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that up because I do think that everyone has something different in their mind when they go to define that. In fact, I think I had a class one time and I was talking about that and I had people to write down on a piece of paper how they would define, topics like diversity or equity or inclusion or belonging. And it was really interesting. I swear everybody in the room had like a different definition. And I was like, that is so interesting, that it's like, how do you come together on something that everyone thinks of as so differently, And that brings to mind, when it comes to distinct differences between, diversity, equity, belonging, and inclusion, what would you say are some of the distinct differences between those topics? Because while they are all said together and are kind of linked and joined together, I
That's
think
right.
diversity, equity, belonging, and inclusion are different things, right?
They are very, very different. If you think about different work domains, think about so manufacturing or is not the same as marketing, is not the same as sales, right? So
Yes.
diversity, equity, inclusion, even though they're said in this long block, they are very different domains of work. So diversity is presence. I would define inclusion as what happens in the interaction when those different presences come together. So, in other words, right, inclusion are the practices and policies that govern what happens and dictates when diverse individuals come together. Equity is if you think about equity as an external lens that looks down at the inclusive practices and ensures that everyone is getting what they need, but not everyone needs the same thing, right? So equitable practices then become something that is a lens to examine your day-to-day practices, to examine the experiences of the people who are in the building. Equity is about making sure that people have equal access and they are getting what they need so that they can be successful in a space. So when you think about those very three different work domains, they require very, very different modalities of work and mechanisms. They require very different things. The easiest thing I can say is, and you've heard this, people use this euphemism, diversity is being asked to the dance, inclusion is being asked to actually dance while you're there. And I would say equity is making sure you're hearing music that makes sense to you when you're in a room. So
I love that.
if you could think about it that way, those would be a way to explain that.
Well, seeing that you've been able to actually implement a program which led to a significant rise in diversity, belonging, equity, and inclusion, where you are now, I think it's fitting to ask you why there has been such a reluctance for people to participate in some cases in these programs. What do you think that's about?
Fundamentally, I just believe people are reticent to change, right? So if something is presenting as something that you're asking me to do that is different than I've done before, I'm naturally going to be resistant to it. It doesn't matter what it is. And I found this over the years, and my therapeutic background has taught me this a lot, right? Which is, how do you get someone who has become habituated? They have the habits and rhythm that they've developed and become comfortable with. How do you introduce something that naturally is just going to be different and cause them to examine the things that they have come to be comfortable with? And it's a difficult thing. So I think first and foremost, I just want to normalize, because people feel like, and this is a problem. When you begin to talk about DEI, people begin to think, oh, well, you're calling me a racist, or you're calling me a sexist, or you're calling me this. And I'm like, slow down. No one is calling you anything. We're just calling out something that we want you to examine and look at a little bit differently, so that to see if there are minor tweaks you can make to how you are doing what you're doing, so that everybody else around you can benefit a little bit more. So I think, to me, that is the biggest issue. Now, when you get into the historical part of it, there are some realities that we have to deal with. There are some historical places that people just don't want to revisit. Or in the US context, I would say there are some things that we would rather sweep under the rug and act as if they never happened. Part of DEI work necessitates going back and excavating some of that history so that we can understand how we got here, right? And that's how I always enter into the work, which is, in order to understand where we are, in order to right size the level of issues that we're dealing with, we have to go back a little bit and see from whence we've come. And once we do that, then we're able to better understand how to have a conversation where we're on the same page. People
Yeah,
are.
I mean, you're saying that, but think about this. I know we're starting to see a rollback in programs like these, across the country in some areas. Do you think that's a mistake?
I do think it's a mistake, and I think it is a mistake for several reasons. I mean, when you look at our country historically, there's been no major advance in our country without legislative decision making that says we are going to create pathways of access for equity, equitable outcomes, be it affirmative action, which has recently been rolled back. So, based on what you're saying, we have to get into that a little bit. So, what does it say when a nation who is built on legislative advance of opening doors? We're a country of immigrants. If we did not have immigration policies that allow the influx of people with different expertise and talents and abilities, our nation would not be as robust as it is. So when you look at the rollback of DEI, essentially it is the commentary of a nation saying, we want to tamp down and no longer make possible the opening of access and equitable access so that we can continue to be the strong nation that we've always been. And this is the thing. So when people say, oh, DEI is not patriotic, there's nothing more patriotic than diversity, equity, and inclusion work. And if I can begin to help people see that and understand that, I think we might be able to have a different conversation with those bodies that want to systematically and legally roll back. I think it's a huge mistake. I think Harvard Business Review, for the last 30 years, they've been producing studies that says teams are more productive, more innovative, and end up adding to revenues at the tune of 37 to 50% higher than non-diverse teams. So for me, the facts just don't bear out. Rolling back DEI programs is going to strengthen corporations and institutions of higher education.
Well, they've always said America's been a melting pot. I know, growing up in the greater Washington, D.C. area, it was always a very diverse place to live. But yet, when I ended up going to graduate school and programs like, at Northwestern, I remember being the only minority in my class and many times the only woman. And they were starting to get more women at the time to enroll, in the master's program there. But many of the people, that I was in school with had never been around people of color, of any sort, So that's a big shock when you come to a larger city, and you have to realize that everyone, I think, not to Jason, everybody comes to the table with, their different mindsets from, lived experience, where they have, experienced things in their own lives that kind of have formulated those differing opinions and ideas. But, when you're around different people, it's good to have an open mindset because you can learn, I think one of the biggest things is you can learn so much from other people, and just broaden your own horizons,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love this.
So
Go
go
ahead. I'm
ahead.
sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I wanted to pick up on something you said around the melting pot because in my years of teaching and preparing counselors, one of the things that we always talked about was, what is the reality of a melting pot, right? If you think about a melting pot, you bring these different elements together. And they melt down, so they lose the original essence of what they were coming into the pot. So what I always would want them to think about is, I think about it in your favorite salad. So your favorite salad, you can add just about anything. I mean, you think about your favorite salad with cranberries and cheese and chicken or whatever protein you want to put on it. And you put it, and it enhances the salad. It enhances the taste and flavor of it, but it maintains the distinctiveness of what it is. And so I think, in many ways, what a lot of DEI work has the capacity to do is shift us away from melting pot, where you have to come into an environment and strip away the things that essentially make you different and can enhance the environment that you're going into. And I think. Yeah, I think when you don't have the presence of a mind, of a consciousness of that, you lose something. So I just always like to, if we can start a trend today, Dr. Celeste, and we can get people to refer to it as salad instead of melting pot, I think we will advance the conversation a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I, you think about when you're adding different things that are different together. There are going to be, some things that don't work well together, so I think having the parameters is why you have, diversity, equity, inclusion. I think that's why you need that, because you want to make it an open enough atmosphere and environment that people feel comfortable. To be able to get the best out of them, creatively, or just, sometimes, to resolve the serious issues and problems, you really have to work together. No, what I say, no man is an island unto himself. We all have to kind of work together sometimes as we've seen from COVID. I mean, people, that's one thing that brought people together. It was a bad thing, but everybody had to kind of come together to figure this thing out, working, for me at a medical college, where, the show had to go on to be able to service people in communities. I mean, you had to think of ways outside the box that have never been done before, you know. So, you know, that's one real benefit of all different people kind of coming together to resolve a common issue.
That's
We're
right.
going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about COVID and how that impacts things like diversity in the workplace, if we have a lot more people working from home. So we're going to talk about that in just a moment. We'll be back right after this.
A lot of things have come to a screeching halt due to COVID-19, but you should know that the court system in Tennessee is still open and holding in-person hearings for orders of protection and other types of abuse cases. If you have a hearing date, double-check on where your hearing will be held. If you need assistance on an order of protection or temporary restraining order, contact the Legal Aid Society at 1-800-238-1443 or visit our website at www.las.org.
I'm going to continue with just asking you a little bit about that in terms of diversity, you know, and working from home. You know, do you find that that is really still important if nobody is actually meeting face to face?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think it's even more important. Surgeon General a couple of years ago came out with the number one crisis facing the health of most Americans, and it was isolation. And so when you think about the shift to working from home, sort of being out of office space, being in natural places where you would come together with other people, now that interaction happens across a screen. And so what is true about most of us, the neuroscience says that within probably 1 to 2 minutes of meeting someone, we've reduced them down to one aspect of who they are. And so it disallows us from fully being able to accept all the brilliance that someone has because we've reduced them down to just one aspect of their identity. Why that's important in terms of COVID is when you're on a screen, and if your brain is reducing that person who's in front of you on that screen down to one aspect of their identity, but you have a lot of different aspects of your work that you need to get done. When you don't have in-person prompts or you don't have things in your environment that has taught you how to read different aspects of someone, of who someone is, it will necessarily reduce the productivity of the exchange that you're supposed to be having and the work that you're supposed to be getting done. It makes us less productive when we don't consider who someone fully is. It makes us less productive and less innovative and less creative when our brains are shutting down and narrowing instead of expanding possibility. I mean, really, that is the rub for me with having a mindset where you don't want to embrace a difference in your space, or you are in a virtual environment and your brain is doing this reduction. But what we really need is our brains to be expanding so we can be more innovative and creative and productive with each other. So what I think COVID revealed was this massive lifting of the cover off of this idea that somehow we can be singular in our pursuit, that you can have single sort of race, gender teams, and think that you are going to get a excellent result. I think COVID like revealed that. And so now post-COVID, and we can't mention COVID without the summer of 2020, I think what where we find ourselves is we find that you have to be able to get to a place where you understand that if I want the best from my colleagues, I want the best for my environment, I have to get to a place where I'm seeing things more broadly. I have to get to a place where I'm seeing things more readily and open. And in point of fact, I have to get to a place where, Dr. Celeste, I feel that I'm not isolated within myself and I'm not being seen as just one thing, and I'm not seeing you as one thing, that we can expand that together. And when we begin to do that, I've seen over the last 15 plus years, I've seen all manner of creativity just exponentially explode. I've seen it in college campuses, I've seen it in businesses, I've seen it in nonprofits. I have seen this all over the place, that when you give the ability to come together and not reduce people down to one aspect of the identity. You have this expansion. I've seen creativity just explode. So that's what I get excited about when I think about DEI work.
Right. But how intentional do you think companies have to be with that? Because I think, some people are feeling now like, well, we've done that work and we should be beyond that now. And so we don't need it anymore. And so I think it's important to look at, hey, do we have to be intentional about this?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And the short answer is yes. And what I would ask companies, do you ever stop doing market research? Do you ever stop doing competitor research? Do you ever stop doing research and development? I would say the diversity, equity, and inclusion and the actual empirically based outcomes that it has shown is as essential to your business as do you ever stop evolving in your marketing? Do you ever stop evolving in the core parts of your business? And I would say that it is a mistake to think that it is it has an endpoint. Just like those other areas don't have endpoints, if you want a successful business, DEI doesn't have an endpoint if you want a successful business. And that's the value proposition that I would say to any business leader. You need to be investing heavily in that area.
Now, when it comes to hiring practices, that's an area that, many employers can kind of look at, but how can they actually be intentional about promoting equity and fairness?
So this is a great question. I think number one, so there are a few things that you can always do. Number one, having a diverse hiring team is always important. And that is just not diversity of thought. And I know diversity of thought is important, but you actually need to have someone from different backgrounds. If you have that capacity to do so, you have to have that available for folks. The second thing is you have to be asking all potential candidates the same questions. Typically, what you find in biased training or biased hiring practices, you get candidates, and this is just human nature. We will hire people like us if there are no checks and balances on the process. So if you find that you are asking different questions of candidates who are more like you, which is typically the case, you eliminate that by asking all candidates the same questions with a diverse hiring team. And then the last thing I would say is you have to fully examine all of your job descriptions. I would say if you're not using inclusive language and you don't have a read through an equitable lens in your job descriptions, most typically people are, because people are hiring people that are like them, they put the things that are most important to them and it attracts the people who are like them. So you have to have an examination of that. And
Right.
so,
But many companies, Dr. Jason, are using AI now and these keyword searches and just pulling information out. And people are using software to kind of make their resume actually fit with the job description. But I find that those people might not necessarily be the best person or the best fit for the job. It sort of has made it a little bit easier, to hire. But how do you think that's going to impact the whole area, when it comes to, diverse hires and using that software?
That's a great question. So I worked in a college of information sciences and technology. So for 5 years, I spoke to people who were doing facial recognition software, who were doing AI, and they told me point blank, it's biased. It is based on the programmers, and most programmers are, quite frankly, males, white, or Asian. So that's why when you look at those facial recognition software, it was biased against folks of darker skin tones with features that were typically more from the African diaspora. And I would say AI is the same way. Quite simply, I would just tell you it's about input and output. If the input is very slanted towards males and who are white or Asian, it's going to then give you an output of looking for and selecting for that same demographic, right? So I would say we need to be very careful in corporations and companies. Look, it is a present reality. AI is going to be with us. I definitely understand that. But there is something about this human experience when it comes to if you really want equitable hiring practices, you can never take human insight off the table. And that's what I would tell companies. Don't be too quick to pull from that AI software. You will not get the outcomes that you are seeking if you solely rely on that.
Right. I think, it's an easy fix for a lot of people because you got a stack of 100 or more resumes, you're like, how am I going to narrow this down? And, people by nature, don't want to have to do all the hard work, but it's so
Right.
important to getting the right fit, I think for the particular position. Now, in I guess outside of just AI, what are some other common barriers to inclusion in the workplace, that could, that's from the hiring process forward, what are some maybe common barriers to inclusion?
Yeah, there are several. So, one is the screening process, how a screening process is set up and how it works. If the screening process filters out, and if there are uncovered biases that their point line people who are doing the screening processes have, then it will disallow most often candidates of color or candidates of difference from even making it to the point of consideration. Other barriers could be technology in terms of disability, right? And so if you have a process of putting in materials and you haven't considered that there are folks with different abilities that may need different modalities to submit materials, it is an absolute barrier, right? And one of the things that I don't think we talk enough about is disability, quite frankly. And I think there are many in the workforce who are just as able to perform the task and duties of whatever job it is, but they're never afforded that opportunity because they don't have the proper accommodation. So that is absolutely a barrier. And then I would say another barrier is when an industry has a profile of worker that they think is successful, then there are many studies that look at this. There's a screening out process that comes just when people come, they submit a resume. If their name is phenotype, if it sounds, and I'm going to use this language, Dr. Celeste, if it sounds like a black name, or if it sounds like a name of color, or if it sounds like a name from a different country of origin, one of the barriers is that that resume will not even be fully considered because they will stop at the name. So things like blind resume reviews, and I don't like the nomenclature, but it's just what we call them. Anything that strips away someone's ability to have bias at any point of the beginning process is going to be the thing.
Yeah, that is so true, and I think a lot of people aren't even aware that they're doing that, that whole unconscious bias piece. And I know you've had some experience in that. How big of a problem do you think that is?
Dr. Celeste, I would say it is the number one factor in unconscious or implicit bias, number one factor in workplace conflict, of poor hiring practices, poor retention practices, and poor supervision practices. When someone is not aware that they have a bias toward a particular group, a particular sound, a particular way of being, when they don't understand that they have that, and it shows up in how they interact with their colleagues, how they interact with their subordinates, how they're supervising. To me, it is the number one factor for why many people of color, people of difference, experience additive stress in workplaces. And it is the number one factor that I think. You talked about these barriers. It is the number one barrier in organizational culture. I come into work and my colleague comes into work. We may have the same set of tasks, but we are having a very different experience. My colleague has no idea that my differential experience is impacting my ability to come and do my work. I'm having to work twice as hard I see them working with relative ease. They leave at the end of the day and they go to a happy hour and they're having a good time with no worries. And I'm having to go to some chiropractor because my stress is located in my back because I'm working twice as hard. So bias and the non-recognition of bias in environments, I think, is the number one factor of why there are these differential experiences. And I think if businesses and corporations knew more about how to solve for when bias shows up, I think they would absolutely be more productive, and they would have a more satisfied workforce. And they will have better outcomes in terms of productivity. This is my contention.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me. I think when companies perceive that they may have an issue, I think what I notice is the first thing they do is they want to put out a survey. Okay. And then everybody's like, oh, what happened? Did somebody do something? And really, to me, I don't know if you agree with this, but the time to do that is before you have a problem, not after, because then people are going to feel really uncomfortable, admitting what may be a reality, or how they may perceive something. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think you have to release climate or environment or these type of surveys in times of relative calm, because we're all susceptible to this. Something happens. Something is happening in the world. It trickles into the workplace, or something happens in the workplace, and there's this huge conflict that arises. And then I get this survey, and you expect me to be straight with this survey after the fact, right? And especially environments where, let's say you have, let's call it a predominantly white environment, and you have a smaller percentages of folks of color. So it's almost obvious who is rating what based on the demographics in the company. And all of this, there are fixes for all of this, but I think that's a mistake to do it in times of high conflict, because you're getting a snapshot. A survey is nothing more of a snapshot of what our organizational culture is at the time. And if you do it post-conflict or in a time of tumult in your organization, that's the snapshot you're getting, but that may not be what it's like most of the time. So now you're engineering a response based on a snapshot that is not the majority of the time, and it's giving you outcomes that you don't want.
That's so interesting that you're bringing that up. That's a really good point. And I think another thing that a lot of companies fail to recognize when it comes to diversity, especially in inclusion, and dealing with people with disabilities. That's a big one because I think you have some people with disabilities that have hidden disabilities. And the surveys and things that I've seen, dealing on the HR side, a lot of times they focus on visible disabilities. Maybe you broke your leg or you're in a cast or you have to use a walker or something like that. But then there are many people who have other disabilities that people aren't even aware of, and that, like you said, having to work twice as hard or what have you. Because people aren't even aware, or everybody isn't born with a disability. Sometimes people obviously get disabilities, and then many times don't even know what accommodations might be. Because I was going to ask you that earlier when you talked about accommodations. What are some accommodations that people with disabilities might, since you touched on that, you didn't really touch on what type of accommodations there may be in the workplace for people so that they can be aware of those things and how they can get more information on that.
So the ADA 1990, and then the additions to the ADA in 1998 makes it possible for every person who's working in the United States to ask for reasonable accommodations on their job, right? So the Americans with Disability Act. And it's interesting that it took till 1990 to have some comprehensive legislation around disability like this. but it makes it possible for everyone who has a reason, and I'm saying that word reasonable on purpose because I think reasonable accommodations come into play when people come into asking for things that are outside the framework of what the ADA says it protects, right? Most accommodations cost less than $20. Most non-structural accommodations in workplaces cost less than $20. But to your question about what are some of these accommodations, it could be things like, let's start with time. So an accommodation of time could be I can get the work done, but I just need time and a half, what we call time and a half. And you see this a lot in higher education, but you should also see it in corporations. Other accommodations are I may just need a pad. I may have a hidden disability where I have some chronic pain in my back. I may need a pad that sits on my seat, or I may need a ball where I can have movement in my seat, right? So I may just need a different chair. I may need some lifts or something that elevates my desk so that I can stand up so that I can get sort of greater movement along the day. I may need a screen, and this is one of those things that are less than $20 that goes over my monitor so that it enhances and better defines what I can see when I'm doing my work, right? So
Right.
these are examples of low cost, very accessible accommodations that people with disabilities on the job that cannot always be seen. And if I can just say a quick point about that, I think it is so important to understand. There's a word you and I are familiar with, and I want to familiarize this audience with, but different types of disabilities carry different weights of stigma. And most of us have lower stigma for physical disabilities that we can see. The more invisible and the harder to explain the disability is, something like a mental health diagnosis, the more stigma that is associated with it, particularly within workplaces, right? And so what may present as a hidden disability that is very real, that has a diagnosis that the ADA covers, a colleague may think I'm just being lazy. And this disallows me from coming forward and seeking the accommodation I actually need so that I can do my work at the same rate as my colleagues.
Right,
So
because at the end of the day, I think companies are trying to produce the best, possible outcome in terms of getting the work done. And so I think, there could be more done in many organizations to listen to people and like I said earlier, maybe doing some of these the surveying prior to an incident or what have you would really be beneficial to kind of bring some of these things to the forefront before they become issues, sort of a little bit of what we call proactive planning, right?
Yes.
I wanted to ask what are some other things also that you think, Dr. Jason, that can be done to create a culture of inclusivity and belonging?
So the one thing that I think most often about is with both with schools and corporations is there's a focus on who is our actual customer, right? Who are we serving? And how do we serve them best? And so many things are done to find out what are they thinking? What do they think about the service or product? What, you know, less is thought about in terms of your internal customers, who those are your workers, your internal employees, right? So the same strict and stringent and robust ways that we're trying to figure out what our customers need and want and anticipate that need, that same focus needs to be on your internal customer, who's your employee. So more opportunities to listen. So I think not a month should go by that is left to chance, knowing what your employee base feels about the place that they work and the interactions that they're having. And some supervisory touch point, some type of it could be a survey, could be a series of focus groups. Could be one-on-one. It could be someone externally coming in, doing some interviews, right? And then putting together some kind of summary. But But we need to treat our internal customers, our employees, with the same reverence as we do our external customers. That's number one, right? The second thing is, I call this environmental belonging. What are your internal employees or your internal customers? Let's call them our internal customers. What are they looking at and interfacing with every day? What's being reflected back to them? So there's a lot companies can do just with environmental belonging. What's up? So this is what I call what's on the walls and who's in the halls, right? What am I interacting with on a day-to-day basis that is reflecting back to me that you value who I am, right? At least on one or maybe more aspects of who I am, what is being reflected back to me? So environmental belonging is what's on the walls, what's in the halls. So what's being reflected back to me through internal communications? Do I see myself? Can I read myself into this communication that's coming to me? So those are things that are things that can be intentionally engineered to serve your internal customers, your employees. But if you're not mindful of them, now you're leaving to chance what I'm coming to work feeling, what I'm coming to work noticing around me, what I'm coming to the place and the interactions I'm having, you're leaving to chance how I feel about that. And if you're leaving that to chance, what else are you leaving to chance? It does not motivate me to come to a place that does not reflect back to me that you highly value the core places of who I am, the core dignity that I have. So for me, Dr. Celeste, I think those are some basic things that I think companies can begin to do. And it's a mind shift in some places because if I come and I only feel like I'm imminently replaceable. Now that may be true, but you can't reflect that back to me and expect that you're going to get my best. So companies that are better with that and have internal employee loyalty, I think these are the practices that they do.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation. We'll be back right after this.
When it comes to relationships, there are some obvious signs you can use to spot someone who might be abusive. First, they have a tendency to want to rush into a relationship. They may also show signs of jealousy and mistrust, and you could find they expect you to be perfect and will try to cut you off from other important relationships. They could also be abusive towards animals and children. To learn more about the signs of dangerous individuals and how you can identify and avoid unhealthy relationships, contact the Legal Aid Society at 1-800-238-1443.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Celeste Stein Show, and I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein, and we're with Dr. Jason Gines, and we're talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging today. And Dr. Jason, you're doing an excellent job giving us so much wisdom here. I wanted to also ask you, we all bring our own individual biases to the table, but how do you think an individual, or how would you recommend that an individual challenge their own biases and be able to promote better diversity and inclusion in the workplace?
No, this is a wonderful question, and I think the first I would offer three very quick ways to check my own bias. Call it the ABCs. So the first thing I would do is I would check my awareness, and I would have an awareness partner with someone who either thinks differently than me, who comes from a different background than me, therefore can offer me a different perspective. So I would have a bias accountability partner, and I have to open myself up to that because in and of ourselves we cannot always see the ways in which we have become biased to something in a particular way. So I would have a bias accountability partner in my space that can raise awareness for me. So that's the A, raise awareness for me that I may be biased in a particular area. Then with that same accountability partner or structure, right? I would say I would have a sort of weekly journal on my behavior in and out of moments, right? So let me give you an example for this. I have a particular work function. So I have to interface with the team. And every time I go to work with that team, I get this feeling on the inside. I get this feeling of dread. I get this feeling like, this is the last meeting I want to go to. This is the last thing I want to go to. And if there is any way that I can get out of going to this thing, I will do it. And
Yeah.
so because my expectation is in that way, my behavior will surely follow the expectation when I show up to that meeting. So what I would begin to do if I really wanted to check my bias and what was making me biased before I entered into that meeting, I would begin to keep a journal of the behavior that I had in that meeting. And then I would ask people in that meeting to give me feedback. And this is where, Dr. Celeste, we have to stop being scared to receive feedback. I would ask feedback and then I would take notes. And then I would look at that journal over a month's time and see what have I actually been doing? And how can I actually, if I've been having someone check me on my bias and I've been trying to change this behavior, in a month's span, have I been able to get different feedback from folks? And then the last thing I check are consequences. What are the consequences of my bias? So these are things, so this is a structure that I think is executable by all of us. We can raise our awareness, we can check our behaviors, and then we can look into the consequences. And if the consequences are not what you believe is leading you down a successful path, or if you're being told by someone and receiving feedback, if you keep having these behaviors, the consequence is going to be you don't have to worry about coming to this meeting because you won't be in the building. Then I might need to check what I'm doing. So that's a real practical way that I could teach people how to begin to check their own bias.
Yeah, great for individuals. Great points there. But how can an organization overall measure its effectiveness of their diversity and inclusion initiatives? The go-to seems to be a survey, but that's not always necessarily measuring how totally effective a program is. Are there some ways that you've used since you have had 100% effectiveness in some of the things that you're doing? What would you recommend that an organization really look at to, make sure that they're hitting the mark and are really effective in their initiatives?
So I would say there are five big metrics within DEI work that across disciplines, across whether it's education, nonprofit, or corporations. Three are numerically based and two are experience, right? So the first one is every company worth its salt who wants to be doing work in the space of diversity needs to be running 3 to 5 year trend analysis on their hiring and retention numbers. So when you think about in a 5 year, 3 to 5 year span, how many diverse individuals, however you want to frame that diversity for your company, right? How many diverse individuals have you hired over a 3 to 5 year span? And what are the percentages therein? And then looking at those retention numbers over that same 3 to 5 year span of those diverse individuals that you've hired, however you define that, how many have you been able to hold on to and persist with employment? The second big number is how many number of bias incidents have you recorded over that same 3 to 5 year span? And can you disaggregate that by the race, ethnicity, gender, if you're tracking these numbers down this far, those across, regionality and things of that nature? Can you track that number over a 3 to 5 year span? And do you see an increase? Do you see it staying the same, or do you see a decrease? And do you see that happening at upper levels, or do you see it happening at more sort of frontline levels? The last number that I would say are your promotion and growth numbers, right? When you're looking internally within your company, is it easy for me to go on your website and I'm looking at your leadership? I'm looking at your mainline employees. I'm looking at your frontline employees. if that basically plays out a lot largely along gender or racial or ethnic lines, probably a problem. And if I'm looking at a 3 to 5 year span of that, it is a telltale sign of something being something that needs to change within the system.
Well,
The
how
two.
can an organization actually, address some of these systemic barriers to equity and inclusion? You find that you have something and you've identified it as a problem. What needs to happen next?
So I would say there's sort of two interventions that I would lift up. One is the answer may not be in the building. And so you have to bring in a professional, someone who can come in and walk you through and quite frankly, command a different respect. Because if people have a perception that you're not good at something, then when you try to be the one saying it, people may not respect it initially. So I think you have to bring in some expertise to help you bring the levels up. The next
How
step I would say.
important though, well, I'll let you go ahead. I'm sorry. I was gonna ask one more thing, but you go
No,
ahead.
come on, come on, Dr.
I'll
Celeste, I'm
follow up
ready.
with it. I was just gonna say, how important is it to have the buy-in of leadership though? Because you can bring in that outside person, because maybe HR thinks it's a good idea, but I think it's so important to look at leadership and how they actually, how they say things often trickle down from the top. So, how do you get leadership at leading actually on that?
Yeah, I would say it's a great point. I would say that is hugely important. I would say, but that buy-in has to have some what we call in research artifacts. So it has to have some real tangible teeth to it, you know. So I think you actually lose more when you have leaders who put out rhetoric as if they're bought in, but then there's no funding mandate, there's no resources allocated to actually see anything done differently. And I actually think that ends up hurting companies more than helping them in the long run. So I think helping the leadership understand what buy-in looks like, I would say there's a whole industry probably, this is a, just sitting here thinking about it, there's probably a whole industry necessary to help leaders understand what true buy-in looks like. It is not just optics, it's not rhetoric, it's not a mass email saying, oh, I'm super committed, but then over that, you know, then you release the numbers or I ask to see the last 3 to 5 years of who we've hired or who we've retained. And actually it's not stayed the same, but gotten worse. But now you have this email and all this thing that I'm super committed. It's a disconnect. And then when you have that incongruence and from your workforce, there's an erasure of trust that happens with your leadership. So this is actually, I love to talk to leaders about this because I love to say, okay, they say, oh, I'm really committed to this. And then my next question is, well, what does that mean for you? And what does that mean for how you're going to allocate resources to this? And then the conversation goes very differently, very quickly.
Because that's a big part of it. If you're not, you want it, but you're not willing to put the dollars behind it to make it all come together, that sends a message. It's what is one of those things that your actions are speaking louder than your
100%.
words. And so important to have those match. And if you're not ready to do it, then maybe wait until you have all the ducks in a row before you say that this is something that's important, when your actions are showing it's really not, because there's no initiative behind it.
That's
So
right.
very, very important. And I think that's, well, that, great, great point. The other thing I wanted to ask a little bit about privilege. Sometimes I think that can play a role in discussions around diversity, equity, and inclusion. Do you see that taking place where privilege or entitlement in terms of how things should go or be run within an organization? What impact does that privilege play?
Yeah, I mean, privilege and my simple armchair definition of it is unearned advantage across different space. So this idea that I can have this unearned advantage everywhere I go, and therefore entitlement is you need to respond to my unearned advantage in every space that you encounter me. So when I think about privilege and I think about when I think about the outgrowth of what entitlement is, it's an economic question. You know, Dr. Celeste, it's funny. When you think about privilege through a lens of economics, and I don't just mean what you have and don't have, I just mean when I have a unearned ability to earn wealth at a higher level than you, then that makes some people think that I'm intellectually better or I'm somehow morally or ethically better than you as well. But it's real funny that when you sort of look at and you equalize the economics of a situation, the financial sort of parity of a situation, and then you put people in a place where that economic parity is the same, and people can't and they know that you've earned what you've gotten versus this unearned privilege, then something comes into place where they almost have to strip the move is to try to strip away the fact that you've earned what you've earned, the fact that you are where you are, and the fact that you have what you have. And this is, to me, the seat of how so many processes begin to be biased in particular ways. You know, they begin to say, well, if we just don't let you in the first place, you can never reach that station again. And that's where you begin to see restrictions. Or they begin to say, well, okay, well, we'll let you in, but we'll only hire you at a certain level because we need to maintain. And so that's where a lot of things live. And when you really begin to understand it at its deepest level, you can start to see it all over the place. And to me, I've become less, the more that I've learned about it, I've become less emotional about it. And I can just speak directly to it because it really is something that is, I think it's something that we collectively need to begin to really talk about at a deeper level. And I think it will make us all better for sure.
Absolutely. What a great point. You kind of peel down those layers and get rid of the emotions and really start to look at the issue. You can get a lot further ahead and recognizing certain things. And then, hey, we all need to do better, right? So I
100%.
really appreciate your time today, Dr. Jason. This has been wonderful. Unfortunately, we're about out of time. You are a wealth of information, and we definitely will have to come back and continue this. The time went by so incredibly quick because we covered so much, but I do appreciate your time and really hitting on the importance of diversity, equity, belonging, and inclusion. If you would like more information on Dr. Gines or would like him to speak at your next conference or training event, please reach out to bsaprinc.com. That web address again is bsaprinc.com, where you can book Dr. Gines to speak. That is all the time we have for now. We'll be back again with more new live content in 2 weeks. I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein. Thanks so much for watching, and don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to my bbsradio.com and YouTube channels. We'll see you next time.